Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife. This is the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. Our last episode took us, with Dorothea, away from Rio, which she had loved. Husband, that is, Captain, Fred, bought her a diamond ring there, which helped smooth over many, now seen as minor, irritations. Soon after spending New Year's Eve and New Year's Day in port in Rio, the good ship Hopkins was towed out to sea. For the first time, after being on land for several weeks, Dorothea did not have sea fever. She was sorry to leave the pleasures of Rio. But the winds are good, and domestic chores, as well as writing in her diary, have Dorothea looking forward to more adventures and maybe a baby. We're in the middle of her entry for January 12, 1912. Here we go. All this apparently brought on by Fred spending half the night telling me of that awful Goodspeed girl, she of the Boston culture, which must breed vermin. She must have been quite a bed gymnast. I told him to go back to her if that was what he wanted. Said I'd lived long enough in Latin worlds to know that men were not monogamous, that every Latin bride I knew expected to accommodate the horror of having her new husband soon tire of pure and good wedded love and run out to seek their old bedmates. He was taken aback at that, like a ship suddenly encountering a squall. Did I really mean it? I said I couldn't find time away from the finer things of life to crawl through gutters. Fortunately, just at that time, his fish line went taut, and he sprang on deck, naked as birth, and became jubilant over a dolphin. That shows where his mind is, and his heart as well. Thank God for that fish! I did not tell him I was 2 months pregnant, because he would get some of that vile medicine in Barbados, and I'd get sick and have no baby. I think he thinks he loves me, but he has the oddest way of showing it. A diamond is supposed to make amends for talk of Goodspeed in the other 40, but knowing what it's all about, merely an attempt to stimulate activity, like reading lewd books, I twirl my diamond on my finger and let him rave on. Meanwhile, I try to do what is right, and that means having my baby. Then I shall have everything. And so, my girl, be buxom, blithe, and debonair, and bring with thee jest and youthful jollity, especially quips and pranks and wanton wiles. Concentrate on the wiles, my daughter. It's a better way than a frontal resistance to a 6-foot-2-inch sea captain with the power of a Russian czar over his ship kingdom. January 13, 1912. My suggestion that he feel free to associate with other women shook his Calvinistic facade of righteousness to his timbers. He has been moaning and groaning about how bad he was to me. I can stand the Victorian self-deception, for I know about Prince Edward going from brothel to high mass within the hour. But I shall let Fred writhe a bit. It's good for his soul. Basically, he's just a healthy stallion and can't get enough. But when he plays Sunday school, it revolts me, and 'tis hard not to show it, although I must not let him know that I see too far through him. He must feel superior, and so the wanton wiles. At night under the moon I walked the after deck and brought my thoughts back to what I think makes Fred tick. In Port Clyde I noticed a bawdy, jolly, lusty Elizabethan remnant now mixed with, but not thoroughly blended with, the Baptist code of conduct which has been superimposed. The Downeasters are not a colloid or a solvent into which the basics have lost their identity. One moment the lest comes out, the next moment it settles to the bottom of a crude mix, and on top appears the righteous element. One moment the preacher is ridiculed as a sky pilot, the next he is revered in the parlor on Sunday as arbiter of who shall be saved. One moment Fred and his seagoing peers from Maine are like the squire in Fielding's Tom Jones, ready to roll in the hay with anything that can accommodate their lust. The next moment they boast of the stained window they gave the chapel. Their Sunday go-to-meeting faces are shed as quickly as their blue serge suits and become goatish leers of pure corruption. The village is loaded with Lowells, Conants, and other old Puritan names, the descendants of the boys sent down east from Plymouth and Boston and Salem to fish for the greater glory of those Lowells and Conants who stayed home and went to Harvard. The down east cousins don't write much poetry, but their low brows outsmart the fish, and their broad bottoms, low slung to make good ballast for the dories, are more practical than the high brows of their southwest relatives. If east met west, they could hardly communicate unless the talk was of herring. But amongst the villagers of Herring Gut are the Simmonses of black-eyed gypsy stock, their ancestors said to have been rounded up by the agents of the Hanoverian kings and shipped as good riddance from around Bremen to Bremen, Maine, and the Dour Scots-Irish who were brought over by the old English stock to man the quarries. The Lowells and Conants remained free of the enticements of emotional religion. They have no congregational church as their Boston cousins do, the same church my Brewster and Moulton and Dorrance ancestors took west with them. But they have not succumbed to the extremes of the rest of Herring Gut, all Baptists, if well-to-do, and Advent, if poor. The Lowells, Conants, Huppers, and Trussells keep what little religion they have strictly unemotional. If they are overheard humming a hymn, it is not "He walks with me and he talks with me," but something a bit less emotional, such as "Let the lower lights keep burning, send a gleam across the way. Some poor struggling seaman you may rescue, you may save." That hymn may have been written by one who wanted to entice seamen to be saved in a religious manner, but the descendants of the old English look upon it as strictly a lighthouse-keeping job to aid the sailor, whereas the emotional descendants of the Germans and the inheritors of Celtic underhanded rebelliousness against the English both cling to the feverish hope that supernatural allies will compensate for their lack of get up and get. Fred inherits the individuality and strong independence of his English ancestors, but there has rubbed off on him, as on his mother and all the Huppers and Trussells, a bit of the wild and orgy-prone proclivities of the Germans and Celts, a sensuousness that is the other extreme of holier-than-thou religiosity. It is an addition to the old English Elizabethan jollity, and it results in what I'd call the third type of maniac, aside from the coast and swamp categories, the sex maniac. So, my daughters who read this in years to come, when at sea, at night, with a down-east skipper, never say yes when being wooed, especially when there's no other woman within 100 miles, not counting seasick ones like Betty. His lust will blind him to the faults or shortcomings which he will later soberly see in you. For example, Fred expects me to spend all my time cleaning and picking up, when he should have known that I'd rather read. My room at college was a delightful pigsty. He expects me to couple with him at least once a night, but, as much of a hedonist as I may feel at times, there are times when I'd rather hear an opera and participate in bedtime gymnastics. Never be too quick to give in to saying yes. Wait until you've found out whether he expects you to be a ship-shape cleaning woman daytimes and a bawd at night, and if he does, tell him you're not signing on for more than one voyage. And don't be overwhelmed by a lovely nose, although I know you will, being my daughters. January 13th, 1912. Aren't my diamonds bright, and how they do sparkle? Each time I fondle the ring, I think of the little skull-capped Mendoza, the Brazilian jeweler, who picked out the finest of his lot for me, because he said I was simpatica. While Fred quibbled about the price, Mendoza told me in Portuguese not to worry about the price, that it would be low, but he wanted to have some fun with Fred. He had been impressed, days earlier, when I visited his shop, by asking him if he was any distant relative of the American Mendozas, which he was. He was delighted that I knew the family history. Sephardic Jews who were the backbone of Spanish banking, close advisers to Charles V, Carlos Quinto, kicked out of Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella's super-Catholic bureaucrats, welcomed, for a time, in liberal Portugal, and then on to Amsterdam for asylum, whence to Recife when the Dutch ruled northeast Brazil, until they gave it up when the sugar and slave trade became more profitable in the West Indies and Georgia. The American Mendozas came from Recife to settle in Newport, Rhode Island, managing the sugar imports and the slave trade, then quite honorable, and helping finance supplies for General Washington's poor troops at Valley Forge and Trenton. January 14, 1912. Finally finished that awful washing and ironing. Glory be to the highest. Feel like sin, death, and destruction. Spinoza was one of those Sephardics like Mendoza. So was his philosopher peer, Averroes. Brilliant they were, and transmitting from Alexandria the sacred Greek learning to southern Spain, while northern Europe was getting back out of barbarianism after the long eclipse of Roman culture ruined by the German and Asiatic tribes. Old Mendoza of Rio had all that in his sorrowfully smiling eyes, and I'd go so far as to say that you can see somewhat the same look on the face of young Sadie Marcus of the Stonington Furniture Company in Rockland, whose father, by the way, was a close friend of Captain John Hupper, Fred's intelligent grandfather. Captain John helped Mr. Marcus get going with his first store, which was at Port Clyde. Back in Squire John's time, three factories were running, packing clams and fish, and supplying the Grand Banks fisher fleet with ice and bait. Then there were three shipyards and scores of vessels coming and going, with cordwood for the lime quarries, paving blocks for the waterfronts of the world, and fish. Large square riggers sailed out of Thomaston for China, and came home with gold and glory. John Hupper's daguerreotype shows eyes that were au pair to all of the world and its activities, the same look one sees on old Mendoza's face and Sadie Marcus's. Isn't it wonderful to have your fingertips on the pulse of the world's system? The English founders of the main coast economy had that feeling. On Bradford's Island, Gay's Island, Loud's, and scores of others, the settlers' saltwater farms were stopping places for the international trade in ideas, as well as fish and ships. Aunt Arc Ann Marshall tells of her mother, back at the turn of the 19th century, reading the Bible in Greek and teaching the young girl Latin. Her descendants, such as Orus Hupper's wife, follow that tradition, but in a degenerate age surrounded by people who think only of fish and filling their bellies, people who are so far from ideas and Greek that they can hardly read their D.C. Heath primers, and when they do, have to move their lips. Orus's wife is an oddity. Can it be geography? The herring-gut boy of today is nearer the Penobscot Indian than his Jeffersonian great-grandfather was. He knows where the fish will be before they do, and he can stand hauling traps at 4 below 0, whereas scores of his colonial ancestors hold up for the winter, some even returning to England, as did the original Kennebec settlers. At any rate, Fred has no taste for the things our mutual ancestors of the Plymouth, Salem, and Massachusetts Bay colonial endeavors had. Did mine benefit from going west and struggling through loneliness, thus relying on their inner selves, propagating intellectualism and clinging to the original respect for learning? Did his lose that lofty tradition in the rush for material gain? But our off-again, on-again contretemps is not all Fred's fault, my dear. I irritate him with my laziness, my talking too much of such things as opera, and I know I drive him wild when I protest at eating salt beef or salt mackerel for breakfast. Do I really believe the poor darling boy could arrange fresh eggs at sea after we've been out months from land? January 16th, 1912, 33 west longitude, 1540 south longitude. Offshore from where the American Mendozas had a sanctuary before the Dutch were forced from Brazil by the Spanish rulers of Portugal. We tacked ship yesterday and stood off to the eastward with sail on the port side, heading north-northeast, some 2 points more than is needed to get us around the eastern tip of South America, with plenty of room to spare in case the westerly flowing currents are quite strong, what with the southeast trades having been blowing rather strongly and steadily for this time of year. The mate, quote, ain't much, unquote, but he knows his basic weather, or more likely feels it. He says, "The current flows the way the wind blows," and I would never have believed it, but it is apparently true. January 17th, 1912. Going nowhere, very thoroughly. Same tack with strong headwinds. Steward made doughnuts, like lead. Fred gobbled them. Wonderful shrimp salad for me. My ring is a consolation, for all my spiteful remarks about herring gut and the degeneration of sea-going descendants of my ancestors. I know, though, that I would never have had such a ring had I stayed on my father's intellectual farm. Maine waters send forth men who may not read without moving their lips, but they can hire or marry people who can. Is that so far from the old kings and nobles who fought and hunted, but had to hire clerks to keep the records? Charlemagne could not read, but he was no ignoramus. Oh, Dora, now you're rationalizing. Please bring up your own children to be full people, both strong of mind and body. January 18th, 1912. Wrote some letters with my leaky fountain pen. Finished my tan linen gown. Out of antipathy to my natural slovenliness, cleaned the bedroom, but probably wouldn't have done so had I known how much there was to it. January 20th, 1912. Curried chicken for Sunday dinner. The only meal in the entire week that I might relish and enjoy, but spoiled with all that abominable curry. Originally, curry, like salt, was used to hide the taste of oncoming rottenness in meats, but users of it became addicted to it for its own taste. Fred insists I get used to it, says I can't go to sea unless I learn to eat like a sailor. He honestly believes the stuff is a preservative against getting poisoned by old meat, and the way he commands, orders, that I like it. Just as he insists that I must become a bedtime acrobat. Just as he makes me drop my reading, all lies, he says, to help him with his navigation and his accounts. I must drop everything and jump like a seaman when he speaks. If I don't jump and run, he gets that skipper's look in his eyes, which says, "Put her in irons and throw her in the lazarette." Really frightening until I remember that it's merely the second nature of one used to command. Then I stick out my tongue at him and he smiles. Cute? Maybe it's cute, but it's also damn disturbing. My mama would call it adjusting. I call it conflict. He wants his iced tea strong enough to dissolve his throat. I want mine moderate. I make his strong and mine weak. He sips mine, and says it's like his grandmother, old and weak. I say, drink your own, and don't meddle with mine. It's his turn to stick out his tongue. So far, no adjusting. Neither of us adjusts easily. So we shall see what happens. We shall see. Now how, dear God, do I handle this latest mutiny? Out of spite at my wanting to sleep instead of put on a six-act Keith's vaudeville show in bed at 3 in the morning, he tells me that, although I'm 2 months pregnant, he still does not want the child, yet. I say, then stop trying to have one every change of watch. He says, what's that got to do with having a baby? Says I, try having a baby without it. Says he, none of your backslack. That's logic on board the Hopkins. So, to make my point, I say, very well, I'll take some more of that foul stuff you had me take last year in Jacksonville, and peacefully die. Then you can marry a beefy Boston Irish woman who is fit only for scrubbing and screwing. He then asks me what good books I have been reading lately. Last trick of the game to me, but it's rather an empty victory. Of course, when the baby arrives, it will all be to his to fondle and teach crudities to. He'll probably have the baby slurping milk the way he does his pea soup. You'd think it was Chinese the way he plays a symphony in I major whenever he eats. I hope the old steward is flattered. I'm not. I can't turn to anyone for understanding, let alone help, because all the creatures on board are completely and absolutely in his power, and that terribly vulgar deck of cards he acquired from Rodin in Rio, and lying openly on his desk, put there for me to see. Oh, did I ever see them? I waited for him to see me watching them. Then, overboard they went to show him. Then I found those ugly letters written to no one by some perverted Englishman, someone named Frank Harris, and they followed the cards to the sharks. I'll be damned if I shall make ice cream for him tomorrow. January 21st, 1912. Rounding Pernambuco, course north-northeast. No other comment, said enough in yesterday's entry. Time for a bit of thought. January 23rd, 1912. 3426 west longitude, 303 south latitude. Proper equator weather, sticky. Bathed in the lovely copper tub and felt better. Aired clothes unlined and embroidered my linen pillow slip while enjoying the shade of the spanker from my deck chair on top of the house. Hubby on his knees below me painting the deck house. That's as it should be. But his contriteness is no better than his bullying, and so I say, steer the middle course, my dear. But he is not a Socrates, believing in moderation in all things. He couldn't be moderate even in moderation, if that makes any sense, which I don't believe it does. I'm as balmy as the weather. Oh, God, what if I am and he's right? That can never be. To get my reason back, I packed things for sending to Port Clyde, things no longer necessary on board, including the Rio souvenirs, like the 4 little coffee spoons, beauties. Rather than accumulate treasures on board for my barbarian to ridicule, I shall discreetly but firmly start nesting away for shore leave during childbirth. Then I shall take over the best of the family houses, a small one, and fix it into a home for future refuge when the going gets rough. That way I can convalesce from him and be strong enough to put up with him at sea. The best of both worlds I shall have. Damn his lovable nose. January 24th, 1912. Right smack on the equator, and now, says Fred, it's all downhill sailing. Hang on, he says. frosted Stewart's cake today, and when I looked up through the porthole, saw Fred bent over with his rheumatism. Went on deck and saw that the idiot had on neither shoes nor stockings. I laid the law down, sounding like him, telling him to get dressed and stop being a poet. It sounded good to give him hell, and he grinned through his painful grimaces. My mother would have washed out my mouth with soap and water. I seem to have the vocabulary down rather pat, if I do say so. That's all we have time for in this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, The Diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. This is getting a bit raw, but then she's at sea, so I guess she's picking up the habits of the sailors as they go sailing around the world, which was her intention. As I said, that's all. I'm Cynthia Bowman, your reader. Thank you for listening.